As you can see on the slide, I have a picture of the Time cover magazine from 1966. And what it does is it screams or asks the question, is God dead? Many believe he is or think there is no God. And those people are labeled atheists. Others simply say they don't know or doubt the existence of God. And those we call agnostics. I found this interesting in one of the journals I used to subscribe to. There was this guy named James H. Luba, a sociologist in 1914, polled 400 of the best scientists of the time on the existence of a personal God. And by that, he meant one you can pray to in expectation of receiving an answer. When he got responses back and he put everything together, he found out that 32% believed in a personal God. 37% believed in immortality. That same question was asked in 1933. When those results were tallied, the numbers dropped to 13% believed in a personal God and 15% believed in immortality. And then the survey was done in 2007. And that's what this graphic shows. And what we find here is the numbers have even dropped further. 10% believe in a personal God and 10% believe in immortality. So we've gone down to a third of scientists. And actually, on this poll, it was those who believed in evolution were polled. It wasn't just the best scientist, it was those who believed in evolution. And yet we see there's a drop in people believing in a personal God. And then we have this from the Boston Globe magazine of September 2007. And if you look down at the bottom, the question that's asked is, do you believe in God? Do you believe in God? The article inside the magazine speaks about the growing numbers of unbelievers. Some of those notable unbelievers are Karl Marx, and we probably already knew that. He's the guy that communism is based on. Friedrich Nietzsche. Carl Sagan, which is really hard to believe because Carl Sagan was a cosmologist. He studied the universe. And Kurt Vonnegut, an author. Kurt Vonnegut is a strange guy anyway. He used to come to the town of Northampton, Massachusetts because he liked that. A lot of New York people like that little town for some reason. And they'd write articles about him and we'd see how strange he really was. But he was an atheist. In a Pew survey in March 2007, it concluded the nation is witnessing a reversal of the increased religiosity observed in the mid-1990s. So religiosity is going down. People aren't as religious. Oh, and we can add to that. Let me back up a little bit. We can add to that list. As you've probably read, John Stewart shot his mouth off several nights ago, and called God a psychopath. John Stewart's an atheist. I'd like to walk up to him and shake him a little bit and say, what are you doing? Do you not know any better? And he was basing that on the film Noah. He doesn't know God's plan or purpose or why God did what he did. But he's shooting his mouth off. Now, because we don't want to be called atheist or agnostic, we now call ourselves humanists. These believe there is no God or say they cannot prove his existence, and therefore mankind is responsible for taking care of himself. That's what a humanist believes. So it's probably very hard to read the sign. The sign sits in Harvard University in the building that housed the humanist studies. And the sign says, if you call yourself atheist, agnostic, ignostic, non-religious, free thinkers, rationalist, secular, spiritual, skeptic, cynic, secular humanist, naturalist, deist, nothing, or any number of non-religious descriptives, you could probably count yourself as a humanist. And then in smaller print, 1 billion people in the world are humanists. 30 to 40 million Americans, ages 18 to 25, identify with no religion whatsoever. And then I was just, I think I was running through Drudge one day, and there was this thing about atheist groups forming on college campuses, and they have to form in secret, especially in the South, because they don't want their parents and others to know that they're atheists. And one lady they interviewed, it must have been a video I watched, they interviewed one lady, and she says, I can't tell my parents and I can't tell my prospective employers that I'm atheist because I may not get a job. And my parents wouldn't like that. And so they did it. They did another Pew poll on this. And that poll, the recent poll, found that more than one third of Americans aged 18 to 29 now say they have no religious affiliation, compared with less than 10% of their grandparents' generation. So people are getting farther and farther away from believing in a God. We'd rather believe that aliens put us on this earth. Oh, that's more believable than a God created mankind and put mankind on this earth. You know, I can't talk to one of my sons because he's an atheist. And he was raised in the church. But he decided that he didn't believe in God. So, is there a God? An almighty, powerful, creative being who has brought matter into existence and sustains it. Can we know for sure whether or not God exists? And all of us here today should say, yes, we can. There are proofs of God's existence. And so it's my purpose today to examine the proofs of God's existence so we can know without a doubt God exists and put out of our minds what the world tells us and what the world wants us to believe in terms of a creator, a maker, a being who does run our lives. And as we'll see later, that's what the world is afraid of. If they admit to God, then they're going to have to admit that God's going to run their lives. And they don't want to do that because they're humanists. We can save ourselves. Yeah, it's the ninth inning, two outs, but man can save himself. It's going to be quite a shock when he doesn't and he finds out that God has to intervene in order to save mankind from extinction. So without acknowledging the existence of God, man continues to speculate on the formation of the universe. In describing what took place in the beginning and afterwards and after, words or phrases such as perhaps, probably, suggest, a plausible explanation are used. And believe me, they are. I've been a scientist for a long time. And when one writes an article, these are the words that you put in. Even though you may have good proof, not saying that they have good proof of this, but you may have good proof of something, but you have to use these words. You probably don't know over here, but I'm still in college. Yes, I know that I'm ancient. But I'm working on an advanced degree. And the nonsense I've been running through lately is they're trying to turn science into a philosophy and a sociology subject rather than being science so that they can get away with using these words. You know, instead of looking at data and using data to prove things, we look at other things and say, well, that's your opinion and that counts. Don't care what the data says. This slide is an artist's conception of the Big Bang event. And I'm calling it the event because I don't want us here to relate the Big Bang event to the television show The Big Bang Theory, which is absolutely ridiculous. Please, I hope I'm not that geeky or nerdy. I mean, that they're just making fun of scientists. Now, granted, there probably are some that act like that, but not all of us do. Notice the wording used to explain this event. And basically, this is what they sent a satellite up that measured things in the universe. And then, you know, they go way back. And at the beginning, over on the left-hand side, that's where the Big Bang occurred. And then there was this expansion. And as that happened, then planets formed, stars formed. And this is what they say about it. The universe is expanding gradually now. But its initial expansion was almost impossibly rapid. Well, was it impossibly rapid, or wasn't? How can we be almost impossibly? But this is the kind of terms that they use. Almost impossibly rapid. As it likely. And why do we have to use these terms? Because we weren't there. We were not there. As it likely grew from quantum scale fluctuations in a trillionth of a second, that means it started at quantum scale is very, 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 very small. You can't see quantum scale. You know, it started with an atom or it started with a molecule. That's what they mean by quantum scale fluctuations. So this is how they believe it started. Now, we know there's a beginning. Was it this beginning to the universe that I showed you before? Well, we can't tell. We know God started everything. I got a kick out when I was teaching over here at the new school I started teaching at. I read this article to the kids about the gas laws, and actually about absolute zero. And the guy mentions the Big Bang, and this kid just goes, he actually does this. I said, what's your problem? Well, I don't believe in the Big Bang. I said, well, there had to be a beginning, didn't there? We don't know if it's the Big Bang or not, but there had to be a beginning. Do you believe in a beginning? Yeah, but I don't believe in a Big Bang. Okay. I didn't go any further because I wasn't going to make any headway with him. But we don't know. You know, in this idea that it started this way and expanded and cooled and made the planets and the stars, the question is never answered, where did the laws that govern this explosion come from? Because there are laws that govern all explosions. Irrefutable laws that govern explosions. And here are some of those laws that had to govern this explosion. The gas laws. That deals with how gases act. The law of conservation of matter, which tells us that you cannot destroy or create matter as human beings. If we didn't have that law, chemistry wouldn't work. In fact, people thought that that law was never in existence until about the 1700s. They always thought that it was magical, that matter disappeared magically and it came into substance magically. But that's not the case. You have to account for all matter. The first law of thermodynamics, which says you have to account for all the energy. So not only do we have to account for matter, we have to account for the energy. The law of gravity. In order for these things to come, these little pieces in the explosion to come together, even in cooling, they had to be brought together by gravity. The suns had to capture the planets that we see around them by gravity. Where did that law come from? The laws of kinetics, which just tell us how fast a chemical reaction occurs. That's the law. Kinetics just means motion. And it applies to how fast a chemical reaction occurs. So was it almost impossibly rapid? Well, I don't know that the laws of kinetics would allow for that being impossibly rapid at the beginning. We can ask ourselves, were these already in existence? Or did they just appear out of nowhere? The models contain actions that are orderly and governed by irrefutable laws of nature. And so we have proof number one. The existence of active, unchangeable, irrefutable, and irrevocable laws. They demand a lawgiver. They demand a lawgiver. Somebody had to start these. Can we have laws in our society without men creating them? Why would we then believe that laws can be started without, out in nature, without somebody starting them? But we tend to. We tend to believe that. Notice what James 4 says. What I have on the screen is James 4, verses 11 and 12, and I have this from the Weymouth translation. James 4. Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. The man who speaks evil of a brother man or judges his brother man speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are no longer one who obeys the law, but one who judges it. The only real lawgiver and judge is he who is able to save or to destroy. Who are you to sit in judgment on your fellow man? There's one lawgiver. And if you go back and you look at the laws that man has devised, those laws actually stem from the Ten Commandments. Although they'll tell you they stem from a Babylonian king, they stem from the Ten Commandments. Because the Ten Commandments have been enforced since man has been on this earth. There's only one lawgiver. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about the theory of evolution. And the theory of evolution, in its simplest form, states the following. All life forms that are known, including humankind, have gradually evolved, and that means developed slowly, from the most simple to the complex, intricate, and interdependent species we know today. And actually, as you'll see in the next slide, if you trace this back, they're saying we came from rocks. They say we came from rocks that dissolved in water, put the proper nutrients in the water, and throw some lightning in, and everything started. Where did these simple life forms come from? Well, here's Charles Darwin's theory. This was written in the 1800s, and it's not far from what they still believe today. He, and that's Darwin, made the suggestion that life may have begun in a warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity present, that a protein compound was chemically formed, ready to undergo still more complex changes. At the present day, such matter would be instantly devoured or absorbed, which would not have been the case before living creatures were formed. Thus it is the presence of life itself which prevents spontaneous generation from occurring on earth today. Life spontaneously started from a warm little pond with some lightning. And then once that started and once it started getting going, then it ate other life that would, you know, do away with spontaneous generation. In case you don't know, Darwin was an atheist. His father was a preacher, and he did not like his father's beliefs. And how far has this come today? Well, I listened in on a class a couple weeks ago where the guy actually stood up there and said that evolution is more provable than 13 other theories we know about. And my mouth goes, really? And where's your proof? You know, instead of just making that statement, where is your proof? And I'm going to digress a little bit because they are the ones that are to supply the proof. I've got an article here from the scientific magazine Nature, which to many scientists is at the top of all scientific journals. nature, science, well above Scientific American, are these journals. And this, the title of this is Engulfed by Speculation. And it talks about eukaryote evolution. Eukaryotes are what we have in us for cells. Mammals, fish, birds, we have eukaryote cells. So in the absence of direct evidence, science should proceed cautiously with conjecture. But we haven't done that. We keep finding skulls all over the world. Well, this skull's half monkey, this skull's half human. Really? Take a closer look at it. If you really examine the skulls that they line up, you can tell the difference between the monkey ones and the human ones. So why are you giving me this garbage? You ought to be able to see that difference. I'm not a trained biologist. I can see the difference in the skulls. Geologist Charles Lyell warned us not to proceed like medieval scholars who often prefaced absurd and extravagant positions because greater skill was required to maintain them. This was when science was really getting wound up in the 1800s. They would come out with these silly theories, and because it required a lot of skill to prove them, well, that made you smart or something. Scientific speculation, Lyell emphasized, must take known processes into account. This has not happened with the debate on how eukaryotes, animals, plants, fungi, protists, arose. The conflicting hypotheses currently on offer show a curious disregard for mechanism. And it goes on, sir, some more biology speak. But about in the middle of the paper, it says this. In other words, the onus is on the proponents, not the skeptics, to find evidence for their theories. So the one who proposes a scientific theory has to find the evidence. Those who disbelieve it don't have to. You know, and last year I sat in a class where this guy's going on about evolution, and I raised my hand and said, well, you know, this is one of the I don't have my doctorate yet, so they consider me nothing at this school. And I've actually been told that. Until you get your doctorate, you're nothing at this school. Well, I raised my hand anyway, because I know he considered me nothing, and I said, hey, you know, that's, you know, how can you teach, you know, how can you teach this, and how can you rank on me, who's going through a doctorate program, and I do not believe in evolution? Well, it's up to you to prove it. What did I just read? It's not up to me to prove it. It's up to them to prove it. And so they stretch the truth, and they stretch what they're looking at, and they try to make things fit, and they just don't fit. What starts the final paragraph in this article? Much uncertainty, that's one of those words, much uncertainty surrounds eukaryote origins. Yeah, because we don't believe in a God that created the eukaryotes. We think it just came from a warm pond that got struck by lightning. If we go back to this warm pond idea, what you have is you have chemicals that were in this warm pond, electricity and heat that made them into biochemicals. The biochemicals then formed one-celled creatures on their own. I'm sure you've all heard of the book Darwin's Black Box. The man who wrote that book, who is a doctor of science, talks about irreducible complexity. That the very small things are extremely complex, and there's no way that they could have come together on their own. So it goes on, we make these one-cell creatures, then these one-cell creatures aggregate, and more of them aggregate, and they start forming multi-cell creatures. At one point I read an article that said, well, you know, this multi-cell creature decided it needed a head, so it just formed a head. What? Really? And I suppose the brain just formed with it. So what they try to tell you is life came from non-living material, which is not the case. Look at what Louis Pasteur said in 1864. Louis Pasteur finally announced the results of his scientific experiments. In a series of neat experiments, Pasteur proved conclusively that only pre-existing microbes could give rise to other microbes. In other words, life can only come from life. That's been termed the law of biogenesis. Something that Darwin said, well, you know, that's true at this point, but that's because all that life that started was weighed up by the other life that came after it, and now you can't have spontaneous generation. You could never have spontaneous generation in the first place. You have to have life to produce life. And so there's proof number two. Life demands a life giver. Laws demand a lawgiver. Life demands a life giver. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7. And the eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. God put man together. God breathed into him. God gave him life, as he did everything else, from one cell amoeba to every animal that exists, to every plant that exists. God provided that life. Another question that we need to ask is, where did matter come from? Many believe that matter has always existed. In fact, one of the theories about the universe is that the universe had this Big Bang event, and it's expanding, and it's eventually going to get to a point where it stops expanding, and then it's just going to collapse down to this little single point again. And then the bang will happen over again. It'll start expanding, get to a point. So we have this cycle. Don't ask me where they get that information from, because I don't know. But this is what some believe. So you're never doing away with that tiny little piece of matter that they call singularity. But where did that come from? As I said, many believe that matter has a past eternity. It's always been there, will always be there. But nature shows us that that's not the case. What I have here shows us that there's a past. There is not a past eternity to matter. That matter began at some point. This is what's known as a decay series. It is the decay series of uranium-238, which, by the way, is not the uranium that makes nuclear bombs, and it's not the uranium that's used in nuclear power plants. Both of them decay. Both of them have long decay lives. But this is the most abundant type of uranium. And over a process of millions and millions of years, through the nucleus of these atoms that are listed here, losing matter or energy, uranium-238 goes down to lead-206, which is non-radioactive. In other words, lead-206 does not decay. And this is a spontaneous loss of the matter and the energy. Please, when a chemist talks about spontaneity, they're not meaning that it's happening instantly. Look at the time frame for just uranium losing its mass and energy. 4.5 billion years. And what that tells us is if you have a pound of uranium, in 4.5 billion years, you'll have a half a pound of uranium. In another 4.5 billion years, you'll have a quarter of a pound of uranium. Those are called half-lives. How long it takes for half of it to decay. This is a slow decayer, uranium. But this decay shows that there had to be a start. There had to be pieces of uranium that started to decay. They weren't always in existence. There was a beginning to this radioactivity, as it's termed. And a beginning dictates a creator. Even if the Big Bang Theory is true, and we can't know, but if it is true, that requires a creator. And we're actually told that Christ created things out of nothing in the Bible. There was a start. Now, one of the things that has been mentioned in the past that we've been a little bit wrong on is the concept of what's known as entropy, and that we can look at the universe as everything running down. Entropy really doesn't say that. What it just says is that things will go from an ordered state. It's more favorable for something to go from an ordered state to a less ordered state. In other words, it's more favorable for a liquid to go to a gas. And I'm only bringing this up because I don't want us to believe in the idea that there's chaos out there. Everything God does is ordered. There's a reason for it. Let's look at John 1. John 1. And verses 1 through 3. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. So here we see that Christ made everything. If you go back to Genesis, Christ made everything through Him speaking. What does He say about light? Let there be light. And we can probably do that with the animals. Let there be these animal species. The only thing we're specifically told that Christ came down and made was mankind. He came to this earth and took the dust of the ground and formed a human being. I have to take the word of the Bible that the rest of it He spoke. He just said, let there be. And it came into being. God is a creator. Here we have a stellar nursery. You know what a nursery does. It takes care of babies. So what you're seeing is the formation, what they see here is the formation of stars. God hasn't stopped creating. They see that new stars are being formed. So as stars are burning out, others are beginning to take their place. And by the way, this is, if you ever want to see some gorgeous pictures of the universe, go to NASA's website on, it's an astronomy picture a day. And they put up some astronomy picture that was taken at some point. They explain the picture. They explain, you know, that's where I know, how I know this is a stellar nursery, because they said in explaining this, this is a stellar nursery. This is where stars are born. On top of that, did you know that biologists have found and continue to find new species of animals throughout the world? Once again, a couple of weeks ago, there was this American biologist jumping up and down with all kinds of enthusiasm and joy. Because he found a new species of a certain type of fish in the United States. Biologists didn't think they would find anything new in the United States. But he found a new species of maybe a steelhead trout or some other type of fish like that. In England, they're jumping for joy because in a certain place where beavers have not been seen for 800 years, they found beavers. There are people that have been in South America, and this one guy I can remember, he's walking through the jungle on If you go to certain countries in South America and Central America, you can go on these tours through the jungle and they'll show you the wildlife. Well, he's walking on one of these walkways that they made with a railing, and on the railing he takes a picture of this lizard and he sends it out, and somebody says, we haven't seen that lizard for hundreds of years. And yet here it is on the railing. They continue to find new species. God is not only busy creating us into spirit beings, but he still, it appears he's still creating the natural world and out in space. Look at what God's already created. This guy's called a goshawk. He lives in the forest. He's not the red-tailed hawk that you see on the highway. They can't live in the forest. They have to hunt in open fields and out in the open. But this hawk hunts in the forest. And he's specifically designed to do that. He's specifically designed and created to fly through the shrubs, the brush, the trees to go after its prey. And as you know, hawks don't stand still. If they're going after something, they move. So he's designed to do this while he's flying at a high rate of speed. That just didn't come about on its own. It didn't come from a warm little pond that struck lightning, and then all these things got together. And eventually, we get this hawk. That had to be created. So now we've come to proof number three. Creation requires a creator. Creation requires a creator. So laws require a lawgiver. Life requires a life giver. Creation requires a creator. Notice what we read in Genesis 1, verses 24 through 25. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God established kinds. It's not what they call it in biology. I'm not a biologist, so, you know. They go through phyla and kingdoms and all this other stuff. Anybody wants to become a biologist, go ahead. Don't let me discourage you. You'll just have to learn the names of things in Latin. My daughter majored in wildlife conservation. In one of her classes, they had to go out and look at trees and shrubs. And not only did they have to learn the English name, they had to learn the Latin name. She found that class a little difficult. Through the study of genetics, selective breeding, and the comparison of embryos of different species, man has attempted to disprove these verses. Their thought is, well, all these embryos look the same, so that means they came from the initial one-celled creature that started in the warm little pond. And they do look similar. Here you have two embryos. They look pretty much the same. The one on the left side is a pig, or will be a pig, or would have been a pig. The one on the right side is a chicken. But at this stage in development, you cannot tell them apart. They have the same features. The elongated head. The snake-like body. And because you can't tell them apart at this stage, supposedly they evolved. It shows a common ancestor. It's interesting if you... There are some people who have done some studies on genetics. And they have actually traced mankind back to their terms, quote unquote, Eve. Supposedly they've traced mankind back to the original chromosomes in a female as some millions of years ago. And they, quote unquote, called her Eve. But we just read the verse that says that wasn't the case, that God created everything. And it wasn't millions of years ago. Man was created somewhere around 6,000 years ago. Now, to me, what does this show me? This shows me that there was a God that started everything out in one design. And then through the miracle of biochemicals, DNA, RNA, proteins, messages that the DNA contain. The DNA in the pig contains different messages than the DNA in the chicken. And so as those as this develops and those messages are translated into the type of proteins that they need to be, these creatures are going to come out different. They have different, codes, different DNA. It shows a common design to the beginning of life that could only be given by a creator. Now we know the chicken's not going to turn into a pig. We know the pig's not going to turn into a chicken. Do we have different types? Well, yeah. I mean, these are dogs. But we have one breed on one side and another breed on the other side. Can we alter the breeds? Yeah. Some very interesting shows on television that talk about the dog species, the dog breeds. And some of them, they put 10 or 20 different breeds into the dog to come up with the characteristics that they want. They've modified the genetics through breeding, but it's still a dog. They can't change it to a pig or a chicken. Dogs are dogs, cats are cats, cows are cows. That doesn't change. God set in motion a law that prohibits life forms from changing from one species to another. Of course, we see variety as shown in this slide, but they cannot change species. And so we have proof number 4, and that is that kind reproduces after its own kind. I can change the pedigree, but I can't change the dog. I can't change the cow. I can't change the cat as a cat species. I can't make it another species. So life demands a life giver. Laws demand a lawgiver. Creation demands a creator. And the fact that kind can only reproduce after kind follows this law that God set, follows that law that God set into motion. As you take a look at the world, and I'm sure many of you have, you find that things are interdependent, they're complex, they're intricate. Just talked about DNA, but here's a picture of DNA, and you're probably saying, well, we can't see it. How do we know this is a picture of DNA? Well, they have techniques now that will tell us what many of these large molecules look like. And we're pretty sure through the technique of what's known as X-ray crystallography, they came up with the structure of DNA. This alpha helix, as it's called, or this spiral staircase. DNA contains the production codes for every protein your body needs. There are proteins that are just proteins, and then there are proteins that are active proteins. Like the proteins in your muscle, they are active proteins. They move to allow muscle contraction. Other proteins, your hair doesn't, it grows, it gets longer. And there may be some enzymes in there that allow that to happen. But there's other proteins that just, that are your hair. In conjunction with various forms of its cousin molecule, RNA, the protein code it contains is transformed into a functional protein. So this has a code on it. And RNA comes along and it splits open this helix and it derives that code. And then it carries it on to where the protein is made. If one part of this code is messed up, then a defect occurs. It is DNA that makes us physically who we are. Our hair color, our eye color, our skin texture, our height. Is this by chance? No. Can you tell me how the DNA, once it formed in the warm little pond, decided that it needed RNA to come along and break it open and to get the code? These inanimate molecules just decided to do this? Don't think so. In Psalm 139, we find that David said the following, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. Even David, who probably didn't understand the workings of DNA and RNA, but through being in the field tending sheep and having the time to contemplate how the sheep acted, looking at the stars while he was out there in the wilderness, tending the sheep, contemplating, he understood that he was fearfully and wonderfully made. What about the complex and interdependent steps required to produce the genetic code that formed this butterfly's wing? On the left-hand side, it's a look at the butterfly's wing and a magnification of 10 microns. That's 10 micrometers. A meter is about 3 feet long. A micro is a thousandth of that. So this is quite a high magnification, and this is what a butterfly wings look like at that magnification. And then they went 10 times higher in the magnification, down to 1 micron, the right-hand side. What does it take to make those ribs and the interconnecting supports between these ribs that you see? Just happened on its own because the butterfly decided it wanted to fly. I gotta fly. I gotta go to Mexico because I'm a monarch butterfly, so I have to grow wings so I can get down there. No, God made this. If it looks like an aircraft wing over here, you're right. Well, you know what? How did we learn how to fly? Well, we copied the birds and the butterflies. And so here we just see design. This is design. So we have proof number 5. Design in the universe requires a designer. So we have a life giver, lawgiver, creator, set laws into motion for kind to reproduce after kind, and we have a designer. Everything's designed to perform a specific function, even those pesky little mosquitoes were designed to perform a function. What that is, other than to irritate us, I don't know. And nowadays make us sick if we get the wrong mosquito bite. But they were designed for a purpose. Lobsters were designed for a purpose, to clean up the bottom of the ocean. That's why we shouldn't eat them. Designed for a purpose. There was a designer. Go to Isaiah 46. We want to take a look at verses 9 through 11 of Isaiah 46, which it says, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man who executes my counsel from a far country. Indeed, I have spoken it. I will also bring to pass. I have purposed it. I will also do it." God knows the beginning from the end. He knows what's going to occur. He knows when it's going to occur. In relationship to human history, he has written that down in his word. Third of the Bible is prophecy. Some of those prophecies have come to pass. Some of those prophecies have not yet come to pass. Many of the prophecies pertain to the world tomorrow and the end time and the second coming of Christ. Yet throughout Scripture we find God sending forth his prophets to various places for telling the fall and particular fate of governments, cities, and individuals. And in most cases, they didn't listen to the prophets. Nineveh was an exception. They listened for a while when Jonah passed through and prophesied what would happen unless they repented. They actually took to heart his message. But in many cases, the messages were not taken to heart, and the prophecy came to pass. And they came to pass without fail. I want us to go to 1 Kings chapter 21. In this scripture is the prophecy of the demise of a very wicked woman. I can't say if she was the most wicked woman in the Bible. I don't know if Semiramis, who's not mentioned in the Bible, took that crown or if this woman took that crown. But this was a very evil lady. She made King Ahab sin and sin and sin. Actually, she didn't make him. He chose to sin according to her wishes. Notice what 1 Kings 21 verse 23 says. "And concerning Jezebel, the Eternal also spoke, saying, the dog shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel." This is a prophecy that was made by Elijah. Now, if you just flip over to 2 Kings, chapter 9. 2 Kings, chapter 9. And these verses take place 25 years after after the prophecy we just read. "Then he said," and let me clarify who he was, "he is Jehu, the new king of Israel." Very interesting. God had had enough of Jezebel. So what he did is he sent a message to Elisha. Not Elijah, but to Elisha. Elisha got that message. And in it he was told to send his servant to go anoint a new king. So Elisha calls his servant to him and he says, "You have to go and find Jehu and you are going to anoint him king over Israel because he's going to be the new king. And after you do that, after you anoint him king, you better hightail it out of there as fast as you can go." And that's exactly what the servant did. He went and found Jehu, he anointed him, and he got out of there. Now, in the meantime, Ahab has been killed. Ahab's already out of the picture here. So Jehu said, throw her down, because he came into the city where Jezebel was, and she looked out the window. So they threw her down, and some of her blood splattered on the wall and the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. And when he had gone in, he ate and drank. And then he said, go now, see to this accursed woman, and bury her, for she's a king's daughter. Even though she was accursed, he was going to give her a proper burial. Respect for the office that she held. So they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hand. Therefore they came back and told him, and he said, this is the word of the Eternal, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, on the plot of ground at Jezreel, dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as refuse on the surface of the field in the plot at Jezreel, so that they shall not say, here lies Jezebel. God prophesied it, and it came to pass. It came to pass. Well, this is just one example. We can't forget about all the other prophecies, especially the prophecies of Christ, his first coming, his death, and resurrection, which all came to pass. The fact that God can foretell the future and bring it about is another proof of his existence. And so we've got proof number 6. Fulfilled prophecy. God will, as we read in starting this topic, God will fulfill what he aims to do. He will bring it to pass. And then proof number 7 is answered prayer. So here I just grabbed a picture supposedly of David praying. As you know, David prayed 3 times a day, morning, noon, night. But what we need to ask about answered prayer is, what is real answered prayer? What is real answered prayer? Well, one thing it is not, or things that it is not the mere working out of events as a result of concentration. Answered prayer doesn't come by you sitting and concentrating. I wish it did, because I've been doing a lot of concentrating on trying to find another job over the last few months. Hasn't happened yet. It doesn't come by positive thinking. I've been doing that. It doesn't come by a psychological adjustment. You know, you go see somebody and they talk to you and tell you to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. The way we get answered prayer is from being obedient to God's laws, asking according to his will, believing in faith until the answer comes. Let's take a look at James 5:16. Where this verse reads, confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. It only avails much if we meet those other qualifications. We're obedient. We have faith. And we're trusting in God. And we know, as we've seen, that God will carry out what he says he'll carry out. It may not be in our time frame. You know, we tend to want things today. And God may say, well, today's not the day. You may have to wait. But he will make sure his promises are fulfilled. These seven proofs should cement in our minds the existence of God. Man is blinded from seeing the existence of God. He is seeking answers and explanations on his own terms. Let's go to Romans 1. Where have those own terms, his own terms gotten him? Romans 1, verse 17. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. If we open our eyes, we can see. And I wasn't talking about all scientists. There are scientists that actually believe in a creator God. Or an intelligent being. They can see. They can see what God has put there for us to see. As we can, because God opened our minds. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. I can't tell that God exists because I can't tell he made anything. The agnostic is without excuse. The atheist is without excuse. The humanist is without excuse. Because if they dare study, if they dare look, they will see. You know, as simple as looking at the skulls lined up and being able to see that these are human skulls and these are monkey skulls and there's no in between. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. They don't know the truth. And changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible men, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. This is talking about producing idols to worship. Worshiping the creation rather than the creator. And we even do that today. Now, my wife asked me the other day, well, where'd the term Mother Nature come from? Well, it came from paganism. Because they had all these gods, and one of them took care of the earth. And it happened to be a she. And so we've just modernized that. And we call that she God that took care of the earth. In some cultures, she's called Gaia, G-A-I-A. Just call her Mother Earth. It's just the imagination of someone came up with that idea of there has to be a God that takes care of the earth. Well, there is a God that takes care of the earth, but It's not in a panacea of gods. There is one God. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts and to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator, who is blessed forever. And so we've exchanged the idea of us coming from microbes for the truth that God created humanity. This is a great quote to show man's reasoning. This is what man believes. The universe is 10 billion years old because it takes about that long for intelligent beings to evolve. Really? Hate to tell you, but the intelligence was given when they were created by God to Adam. really irritate, you know, one of the things that irritates me about this movie, Noah or some of the other movies that come out, first of all, their dress. Secondly, many of them are made to look stupid. I believe the contrary. I believe man was very, very intelligent for a long, long time. Look, they started to build the Tower of Babel, and God had to interrupt that. Otherwise, they would have gone into the heavens. That's cavemen can't do that kind of stuff, at least the way we picture cavemen. These people were highly intelligent. Go back and look at Egyptian society. Yeah, maybe it was a crude way to do brain surgery, to pull the brain through the nose, but they could do it. People that aren't intelligent wouldn't have thought of that. They studied the stars. They studied nature around them. The Egyptians had crude batteries. Well, at least we say they're crude. They may have been more extensive than we believe. Because unfortunately, a lot of that information has been lost. It's been burned and destroyed. Intelligence was given when God created man. It doesn't take 10 million years for intelligent beings to evolve. But notice, you know, one of the best minds in cosmology and physics today came up with that statement, Stephen Hawking. We are blessed because our minds have been opened to understand the proofs of God's existence. And those proofs are: laws demand a lawgiver. Life demands a life giver. Creation requires a creator. Species have to reproduce after their own kind, their own species. Design needs a designer. There's fulfilled prophecy and answered prayer. Let's keep these proofs in mind so we know God isn't dead, but He is alive and well.